第五天，6.5至9分范文。发展类范文二。
There is not enough respect for elderly people. What are the causes? Suggest some solutions.
We tend to agree that being kind to elderly people is a virtue. However, today, not many young people treat elderly people with respect. The most obvious cause of the lack of respect for elderly people is young people's misunderstanding of them. Elderly people no longer have good looks or quick minds. Some young people laugh at them for this and even play tricks on them. The competition in today's society also results in less patience for senior citizens. Young working people have to lead fast-paced lifestyles and pay more attention to their own work instead of showing respect for and taking care of their elders. In addition, some elderly people may be too stubborn to accept new ideas, so they often feel isolated. It is a widespread problem, but I believe that various measures can be taken to solve it. If the government can set down some rules about caring for senior citizens and provide more public facilities, equipment and services well suited to their needs, the situation can be improved. Special organisations for senior groups may help them to communicate better with people of different ages. Public libraries and community centres can also provide lectures on the latest technology and trends, such as using the internet, to senior citizens. This can help them to keep up with the changes in lifestyles and share more common interests with young people. No matter how perfect the rules and policies are, if there are no people to follow them, they cannot work effectively. Both young people and the government should pay more attention to senior citizens' physical and emotional needs.
Surveys show that in many countries,
people are living longer. What are the possible effects of the increasing life expectancy on individuals and society as a whole?
The increase in life expectancy is an important issue in many countries. The rising life expectancy means that individuals are generally healthier and living longer. Also, as people are living longer, many children are not only cared for by their parents, but also looked after by their grandparents. This generally makes children more emotionally secure and better prepared for school. On the other hand, the increasing life expectancy is leading to population aging. An aging population can put heavy burdens on society and the government. For example, the increasing numbers of pensioners in many European countries have put great pressure on their pension systems. The governments of these countries have to raise the retirement age to prevent their national pension systems from collapsing. The aging of the population will threaten the healthcare system as well. Elderly people are more likely to have health problems that need medical treatment. As the healthcare services available to the public are limited, this means that many people of other age groups will not receive the medical services that they need. Apart from these problems, population aging is also likely to increase the unemployment rate among the younger generation. The raised retirement age means elderly people will continue to work past the age of 65 or even 67. This will reduce the number of job opportunities available to younger people. In conclusion, although the increase in life expectancy means that individuals generally live longer and enjoy life more, it also causes population aging, which is likely to negatively affect people's quality of life. Policymakers should be well prepared for the challenges that population aging presents. An increasing number of people do not know their neighbours and never feel a sense of community. What are the causes of the situation? How can we change it?
Many people today do not know their neighbours, and they feel that community spirit is weak in their neighbourhoods. There are several reasons why we have little or no contact with our neighbours. Firstly, modern residential buildings do not help to promote communication between neighbours. In my country, most people live in blocks of apartments. This makes them feel isolated from other families because there is little public space near their homes. People even find it hard to ask their neighbours for help. Secondly, few people have the time to chat with their neighbours because they are too busy with their studies or work. After they return home from school or workplace, they feel so tired that they hardly have the energy to have light conversations with their neighbours or take a stroll in the neighbourhood. People also move more often for study or work, which makes them less connected to their neighbours. Another reason for the trend is that the modern forms of entertainment, such as watching television and browsing the internet, do not encourage interaction between neighbours. People rarely spend time in public facilities like parks and community centres. To solve this problem, we need a variety of measures to change the lifestyles of neighbourhood residents. Architects should introduce more public space into residential buildings. We should try to spend more time interacting with our neighbours and building a good relationship with them. Community activities can be organised regularly by community centres and schools to give residents opportunities to communicate with each other about matters of common interest or concern. A good relationship with neighbours and a strong sense of community can make every resident's life more comfortable. Although we cannot reduce the time spent on work or study, we can make better use of our spare time to develop strong ties with our neighbours and community. Traffic and housing problems in major cities could be solved by moving large companies and factories and their employees to the countryside. To what extent do you agree or disagree with this opinion?
The rapidly growing populations and car ownership have caused frequent traffic congestion and shortages of accommodation in major cities. Some people think that the traffic and housing problems can be solved by relocating large companies and factories in these cities to rural areas. I completely agree with this view. Employees commuting by car is an important contributing factor to traffic congestion in urban areas. Moving large companies and factories to rural areas can significantly reduce the number of company and factory employees' private vehicles on city streets, especially during rush hours. The amount of leisure-related traffic will also decline because many employees will relocate to the countryside to live closer to their workplace. Another benefit is that the amount of traffic caused by the transport of office supplies and factory products is also likely to fall if larger companies and factories are moved to rural areas. Moving large companies and factories to the countryside also helps to solve housing problems in cities. In urban areas, a high percentage of housing is owned or rented by employees of large companies and factories and their families. Moving these firms and factories to the countryside is likely to lead to the relocation of their employees. This means that more accommodation would become available to other residents of large cities and would help to reduce the housing bubble in many large cities. For these reasons, I agree that moving large companies and factories from major cities to the countryside can significantly reduce the commuting and leisure-related traffic and the demand for accommodation, which would make it an effective solution to the chronic traffic and housing problems in these cities. In most cities and towns, the high volume of road traffic has become a problem. What are the causes and what action should be taken to solve the problem?
Heavy road traffic has become a challenging problem in many cities and towns. This essay will discuss the causes of this problem and suggest some solutions to it. There are several reasons why the volume of traffic has increased in urban areas. In many countries, people's income levels have been rising steadily, especially in cities and towns, while car prices are gradually decreasing. As a result, more people can afford a car. Also, many people today live far away from their workplaces because of the expansion of modern cities and towns. Driving to work has become one of the few reasonable choices that they have if they wish to arrive at work on time. Rapid population growth is one of the main reasons as well. The high growth rates of urban population have made owning two or even more cars increasingly common to urban families. Actions should be taken to tackle this problem on both government and individual levels. The government should improve public transport services available to citizens, especially commuters. For example, by providing convenient and affordable underground and bus services, the government can significantly reduce people's dependence on cars and traffic on the roads. Live traffic updates for roads and motorways can also be delivered to drivers by government-funded radio stations, which can help drivers to avoid heavy traffic. In conclusion, although the high volume of traffic is a serious problem in urban areas, it can be solved by the construction and running of efficient public transport systems, encouraging citizens to use them more frequently, and providing drivers with real-time traffic information. It is suggested that everyone in the world wants to own a car, a TV, and a fridge. Would the advantages of such a development to society outweigh the disadvantages?
It is suggested that everyone in the world wants to own a private car, a TV set, and a refrigerator. I think whether the advantages of such a development would outweigh its disadvantages would depend on advances in technology. Popular consumer goods can generally make individuals' lives more convenient and enjoyable. A car owner can have a more flexible schedule than people who rely on public transport. Television gives viewers access to a wide range of information and entertainment, while refrigerators can help people to preserve food longer than leaving it at room temperature. This is why universal ownership of these consumer products is often associated with a higher standard of living. On the other hand, the possible risks of everyone owning these consumer products should not be underestimated. With current technology, more energy is consumed when the number of consumer products rises, which also produces more pollution. Sometimes, increasing ownership of consumer products does not even lead to greater convenience or higher efficiency. In large cities such as Beijing and Paris, the ever-rising number of cars has caused serious traffic congestion and a significant increase in the amount of time that urban commuters spend on the road. As a result, many of them take public transport instead and leave their cars in their garage. There is also the risk that universal TV and fridge ownership would result in an increase in sedentary lifestyle habits and people buying less fresh food. Therefore, I believe that unless future technological breakthroughs could make popular consumer goods far more environmentally friendly and healthy choices than they are now, universal ownership of cars, TV sets, and fridges would bring more problems than benefits.
In a number of countries, some people think that it is necessary to spend large sums of money on constructing new railway lines for very fast trains between cities. Others believe the money should be spent on improving existing public transport. Discuss both these views and give your own opinion. For many people, the preferred method of transport is high-speed rail. Commuters can rely on the safety and efficiency of high-speed rail, while tourists appreciate the convenience that high-speed trains provide. Others, however, believe that highways, buses, and regular trains should be improved before new high-speed lines are added. Safety is the chief concern for those who travel to work or school on a regular basis. People who drive cars have to concentrate on the road, not only to avoid accidents, but also to prevent other drivers from causing a problem. High-speed rail allows commuters to leave the driving to the professional who controls the train, allowing them to get some work done while getting to work safely. In addition, people tend to move further and further away from city centers, where land and houses are more affordable. High-speed rail allows them to travel greater distances in a shorter amount of time. If we can reduce the number of cars on the road, we can also reduce traffic jams and road delays. On the other hand, high-speed trains are expensive, and some believe this money could be spent on repairing motorways that are used by cars, buses, and motorcycles. Another possibility would be to use this money to build more regular trains and buses to serve the ever-expanding urban populations. Boats and ferries could also benefit from a budget that focuses more on existing forms of transport. Public transport is an issue that affects us all. The taxes which we pay should be spent on the type of transport that has the most benefit to all citizens. In addition, we need to take into account how much the environment is damaged by fossil fuels and pollution. I believe that we need to embrace the idea of high-speed rail so that the future generations can continue to live safely and efficiently.
Some people prefer to spend their lives doing the same things and avoiding change. Others, however, think that change is always a good thing. Discuss both these views and give your own opinion.
Some people like to seek new experiences and explore different things, while others prefer to always do familiar things and resist change. I will examine both these attitudes towards change in this essay. Change can often bring fresh perspectives to us because it involves new situations. For example, travelling to another place can enable us to experience a new culture and different lifestyles. This kind of change is normally beneficial because not only does it make us feel more energetic, it also deepens our thoughts and makes us more open-minded. Young people tend to seek change also because change often means more opportunities for us. Nowadays, many Asian students further their education in other countries as they believe this experience can make themselves more competitive in their future careers. Even many elderly people choose to move after their retirement for better healthcare or a better environment. It seems changes in different stages of our lives generally help us to live more healthily and happily. However, sometimes change can be time-consuming. People may need a long time to adjust to their new lifestyles and new roles. Sudden changes, such as being laid off from a job, may even leave some people homeless. People who do not have a positive attitude towards life may not be able to recover from this type of change easily. Personally, I always look forward to new challenges in my life because they bring me hope. I also believe that it is the positive attitude towards change that helps us to achieve our best. In many countries, the proportion of old people is increasing. Do you think the positive effects of this trend outweigh its negative influence?
The proportion of elderly people in the population is rising in many countries. I think this trend creates more problems than benefits for society. An aging population puts a heavy burden on the social welfare system. The more retired people there are in a society, the more claims are made for state pension. The government will have to increase funds for the state pension system, while reducing funds for other social programs, including financial support for low-income families, unemployment benefits, and student loans. A higher proportion of elderly people in the population is also likely to cause labour shortages, resulting in lower productivity. Not only will this hinder economic growth, it will also cause labour costs to rise. To cover higher labour costs, companies will have to raise the prices of their products and services, a burden that will be borne by consumers. It is true that an aging population may lead to a rising demand for healthcare workers and therefore may create job opportunities in healthcare-related fields such as nursing and pharmacy. However, compared with the negative impacts that population aging would have on economic activities in other industries, the possible growth in healthcare-related jobs would seem insignificant. In conclusion, the rising proportion of senior citizens is a direct result of progress in healthcare and improvements in the standard of living. But I believe that the overall effects of population aging on the social welfare system, the healthcare system, and the economy are negative. The government should extend the retirement age to prevent serious labour shortages. Marriage and childbearing should also be encouraged. Today, food travels thousands of miles from the farm to the consumer. Why is this? Is it a positive or a negative development?
In recent years, there has been a significant increase in the distance over which food travels from its producer to its consumer. There are three main reasons for this trend. Firstly, the rapid development of farming technology and the economies of scale have helped large industrial farms to produce food at much lower costs than small farms do. As large industrial farms are mostly located far from the areas that they serve, food produced by these farms has to be transported over long distances to reach consumers. Secondly, in many parts of the world, consumers' rising purchasing power has increased the demand for food variety. With more efficient means of food transport, consumers in economically developed regions now have a much wider selection of food all year round. Thirdly, the removal of trade barriers between many countries has made it easier for food to be supplied to markets thousands of miles away from their places of origin. In spite of the lower food prices and more variety that increasing food miles can bring us, this trend has also led to environmental, economic, and health concerns. More fossil fuels are used as a result of the longer food miles, which increases greenhouse gas emissions. From an economic perspective, food supplies from large industrial farms drive local food producers out of business and lead to local job losses. Long-distance food has also been linked to many health problems because it often has chemical preservatives which prevent it from spoiling. Supplies of long-distance food items are not likely to be reduced because of the lower prices and wider selections of food that they provide to consumers. I think that overall, the increase in food miles is a positive development. However, the government can introduce higher environmental standards of food transport and subsidize local food producers to address the negative impacts of longer food miles. Today, more and more people are living in big cities. What are the causes of this trend? What problems has it caused?
Each year, many people relocate to large cities. This has caused rapid population growth in these cities. The main cause of this trend is the infrastructure gap between large cities and other areas. As economic centers and transport hubs, large cities offer well-developed public infrastructure, including schools, hospitals, parks, and airports, with qualities that are generally far better than those in small towns and rural areas. Another reason why large cities attract more and more people is that the culture and lifestyle of large cities are more exciting, especially for the younger generation. They have a wide range of shopping centers, sports facilities, cinemas, concert halls, and museums. Residents of large cities generally have access to a much richer variety of leisure and cultural activities than residents of other areas. Large cities also provide more career opportunities, and most jobs in large cities offer better salaries and benefits than similar jobs in other areas. As a result, it is widely believed that people in large cities lead wealthy lives. On the other hand, the rapid population growth in large cities is not necessarily a positive trend. In fact, increasing household waste, rising crime rates, and frequent traffic congestion in overcrowded large cities are making them unpleasant places to live in or visit. Overpopulation in these cities has also put great pressure on resources such as public transport systems, schools, healthcare services, and housing, and has made the competition for jobs tougher than ever. On a regional or national level, the population boom in large cities often means a decline in the young population and labour shortages in small towns and rural areas, which damages the economy in these areas. In conclusion, people are attracted to large cities because of the well-developed infrastructure, exciting lifestyles, and job opportunities in these cities. Nevertheless, the overall quality of urban life may decline due to the environmental and social problems caused by this trend. Some people think that for individuals, planning for the future is a waste of time. It is more important for individuals to focus on the present. To what extent do you agree or disagree?
Some people argue that individuals should focus on the present, and it is a waste of time to plan for the future. While I agree that the present is important, I do not think it is pointless to plan for the future. The importance of paying close attention to the present is obvious. It makes us more focused and efficient because it gives our tasks a sense of urgency. Appreciating the importance of the present also makes us cherish every moment and try to spend it wisely, and relieves our anxiety and tension caused by demanding tasks. However, focusing on the present does not mean that we should not plan for the future. Making a plan and being committed to it can give us a healthy level of pressure to work hard and make progress towards the goal set in the plan. With a specific target ahead, we tend to be more motivated and self-disciplined. Well thought-out plans can also help us to set priorities, be clearer about our tasks, and avoid time-consuming mistakes. For example, if university graduates have clear career plans, they will not waste time applying for positions that do not suit their career plans. Instead, they will concentrate on job opportunities that will allow them to carry out their career plans, which will help them to achieve their career goals faster. In conclusion, I believe that focusing on the present makes us work harder and enjoy life more fully. However, if we only focus on our present interests, we become short-sighted in life. Making plans for the future is an important way to keep us on the right track to reaching our educational, professional, and personal goals. Youth is highly valued in some cultures, while in other cultures old age is more valued than youth. Discuss both these views and give your own opinion.
A. Some people argue that old age should be respected and valued, while others believe that youth is more important than old age. I agree with the view that elderly people can play very significant roles in society and therefore should be respected and valued. Even after they retire, senior citizens can still offer many good suggestions to the government and various organizations, because they have a wealth of knowledge and experience and tend to have a strong sense of responsibility. They can help the government and organizations to make better decisions and policies. Many elderly people can also care for and teach their grandchildren very effectively. Most of them are patient and caring, and can provide their grandchildren with care that the children's parents do not have the time or energy to provide. Some grandparents even set the values by which their families live. They are positive role models for young family members because they are polite and family-oriented. At the same time, I believe that youth is also valuable. Young people's energy and creativity have made important contributions to the development of science, technology, and social and political reform. They are more willing to make changes to lifestyles and accept new technology and ideas. Although sometimes young people make rash decisions and take too much risk, they generally have more opportunities than elderly people to correct their mistakes and continue to grow and develop their full potential. In conclusion, I would argue that we should value both old age and youth. The government should try to create opportunities for people of all ages to achieve their potential.
B. In this essay, I will discuss whether youth is more valuable than old age. Youth is valued in many modern societies where social change is much faster and competition is much more intense than in traditional societies. Young people are more energetic, both physically and mentally. Most of them have a better memory and a more agile mind than those of elderly people. These advantages often lead to higher productivity at work. Young people also tend to be more motivated to pursue change in their lives, not only because of their relative inexperience and their wish to gain more experience, but also because they are generally more open-minded. This can be proved by the fact that some of the most creative firms in the world today were established by kid entrepreneurs, such as Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg, Google co-founder Larry Page, and Kevin Systrom, the young CEO of Instagram. In more traditional countries, however, old age is more appreciated than youth. This is mainly due to the belief that elderly people have gained more life and work experience that young people can draw on. Also, it is generally thought in these societies that the older generation is more calm and rational when making decisions, which can help families, organizations, and governments to avoid the negative consequences of rash actions or plans. My own opinion is that both the younger and the older generations make their share of contributions to society. It is important for individuals to be enthusiastic about what they do, regardless of their age. Some people believe that only the fittest and strongest individuals and teams can succeed in sports. Others think that success in sports depends on mental attitudes. Discuss both these views and give your own opinions.
Winners in sports competitions are often regarded as heroes. However, people have different views about the decisive factor for victory in a sports competition. Some believe that only the fittest and strongest participants can achieve success in sports competitions. This belief is based on the understanding of sports as purely physical activities, and the fact that the results of sports competitions are often determined by the strength, speed, endurance, flexibility, or balance that participants display. It is the objective comparisons of participants' performance according to these criteria that make many sports competitions worthwhile and fair. This is particularly true of individual sports such as swimming, track and field, and weightlifting. Others, however, think that success in sports depends on mental attitudes. Stamina-based sports such as cross-country cycling and triathlon are so demanding that even participants in the best physical condition need strong willpower to carry themselves through the competition and win. Without enough perseverance, a competitor would give up before the end of the race. When it comes to team sports, such as basketball and volleyball, cooperation among team members is so crucial that even teams consisting of players with the best physical abilities may lose if the individual players lack team spirit. For example, if the members of a basketball team only care about how to score points by themselves and refuse to share the ball with and help other members who have better scoring opportunities, the team is not likely to be successful on the court, no matter how tall, strong, or agile its members are. My own opinion is that success in sports requires more than good physical condition. It needs a combination of great physical energy, a winning attitude, and a bit of good luck. If two teams are evenly matched in terms of physical abilities, then the one with more cooperative and determined players is more likely to win. As most people spend a major part of their adult life at work, job satisfaction is an important element of individual well-being. What factors contribute to job satisfaction? How realistic is the expectation of job satisfaction for all workers?
Nowadays, many adults have full-time jobs, and the proportion of their lives spent doing such jobs is very high. So feelings about one's job must reflect how an individual feels about his or her life as a whole. And because of this, job satisfaction is indeed very important to the well-being of that person. Employees get job satisfaction in a number of ways. Firstly, a person needs to feel that they are doing valued and valuable work, so positive feedback from superiors is very important in this respect. A sense of fulfillment is also encouraged if a worker feels the job is worth doing because it contributes to the society or the economy as a whole. Secondly, when someone feels they are improving or developing their skills through training opportunities, for example, then there is a sense of progression and purpose that rewards a worker. The sense of belonging to a team or a working community also contributes to job satisfaction because colleagues help each other to enjoy their working lives. Satisfaction is also increased by a sense of responsibility for and loyalty to a team. Of course, not everyone enjoys their work. Hard economic realities mean that many people have little choice in the kind of job they can get. In some cases, an employee is working in a job that suits neither their skills nor their personality. Some jobs are repetitive and boring, and labour relations may be poor and lead to resentment and insecurity rather than to job satisfaction. However, even though it is unlikely that all workers do feel happy in their work, I think it is not unrealistic to promote more job satisfaction in any job. If the factors identified above are implemented, then any job can be improved and more workers can feel greater degrees of job satisfaction. In developed countries, the average weight of children is increasing. Some people think that this is due to the growing number of fast food restaurants. Others believe that parents should be blamed for not looking after their children's health. Discuss both these views and give your own opinion.
Many children are overweight in developed countries, and the situation has been worsening. Some people think the main reason for this situation is that children have been surrounded by fast food outlets selling unhealthy foods, such as cheeseburgers and hot dogs. Almost all fast food items are high in calories, sugar, salt, and saturated fat, and are served with a great deal of artificial flavoring. These people believe that if there were fewer fast food outlets, then children would not eat so much fast food. Others, however, believe that healthy eating habits need to be formed at a young age, long before children begin to visit fast food restaurants. If young children are given chocolate bars and potato crisps instead of nutritious food, they are likely to become addicted to sugary and salty foods, which can last into adulthood. It seems that the two reasons discussed play an equal role in contributing to the problem, but I think a third contributing factor is that these days most children do not get enough exercise to keep themselves healthy and prevent obesity. They do not walk or cycle to and from school. At home, they spend long hours sitting in their room, watching TV, or playing non-active computer games, which also gives them time to eat more junk food. It has been scientifically proven that inactive lifestyles can lead to a build-up of fat, which causes weight gain. Thus, we should encourage children to be more active, as well as steering them away from fast food outlets and unhealthy eating habits. A large proportion of a country's health budget should be diverted from treatment to spending on health education and preventative measures. To what extent do you agree or disagree?
In recent years, there have been a growing number of people in favour of putting more resources into health education and preventative health measures. There are numerous arguments for intervening in any medical condition as early as possible. Firstly, obviously there is a strong humane argument for the relief of suffering. There is also an economic argument for preventative health measures. Statistics demonstrate the cost-effectiveness of treating a disease in the earliest stages rather than delaying until expensive treatment is necessary. In addition, there are social or economic costs of medical treatment, perhaps in terms of loss of earnings for the family of the patient or unemployment benefits paid by the state. However, the difficulties start when we try to find out what the proportion of the budget should be, particularly if the funds will be diverted from medical treatment. Decisions on exactly how much of the health budget should be spent in this way are not a matter for the non-specialist, but should be made on the basis of an accepted health service model. This is the point at which real problems occur, the formulation of the model. I personally believe that it would be hard for us to accurately measure which health education campaign would be the most effective in both financial and medical terms. It would also be unlikely that we could agree on the medical effectiveness of various screening programs. A highly rigorous process of evaluation is needed so that we can make informed decisions. Some sporting events, such as the World Cup, may help to reduce the tension and prejudice between countries and keep the peace of the world. What is your view?
Many friends are formed through playing or watching sports, and sporting rivalries, although keen, can be friendly. But this is on the individual amateur level. By contrast, the effect of international professional sports on prejudice between countries presents a much more mixed picture. On the surface of the issue, it would seem that the sheer exuberant fun of sports should release such energy and excitement that people would leap over the barriers which divide them and embrace each other in the joy of sharing a common humanity in this directly physical way. That, from what I read, is exactly what Baron de Coubertin expected when he founded the Olympic Games and wrote about his ideals. However, the problem is that without some other strong social bonding mechanisms, such as a shared ideology that takes people and nations out of themselves and makes them devoted to wider goals, sports on their own, except at some very rare moments, cannot make much of a contribution to peace. The reason for this is that sports are never played in a political vacuum. All kinds of other factors are involved: cultural, commercial, diplomatic, and nationalistic. Indeed, the recent history of football competitions illustrates the fact that sports can often worsen relations between countries rather than improve them. The tragic consequences of these competitions only serve to breed hatred and contempt between countries. In summary, I regret to admit that experience shows sports do little to overcome mutual national stereotypes or promote peace between nations. Some people say that the best way to improve public health is by increasing the number of sports facilities. Others, however, say that this would have little effect on public health and that other measures are required. Discuss both these views and give your own opinion.
A problem of modern societies is the declining level of health in the general population, with conflicting views on how to tackle this worrying trend. One possible solution is to provide more sports facilities to encourage a more active lifestyle. Advocates of this believe that today's sedentary lifestyle and stressful working conditions mean that physical activity is no longer part of either our work or our leisure time. If there were easy-to-reach local sports centres, we would be more likely to make exercise a regular part of our lives, rather than just collapsing in front of a screen every evening. The variety of sports that could be offered would cater for all ages, levels of fitness, and interests. Those with painful memories of PE at school might be happier in the swimming pool than the football pitch. However, there may be better ways of tackling this problem. Interest in sport is not universal, and additional facilities might simply attract the already fit, not those who most need them. Physical activity could be encouraged relatively cheaply, for example, by installing exercise equipment in parks, as my local council has done. This has the added benefit that parents and children often use them together, just for fun, which develops a positive attitude to exercise at an early age. As well as physical activity, high tax penalties could be imposed on high-fat food products, tobacco and alcohol, as excessive consumption of any of these contributes to poor health. Even improving public transport would help. It takes longer to walk to the bus stop than to the car. In my opinion, focusing on sports facilities is too narrow an approach and would not have the desired results. People should be encouraged not only to be more physically active, but also to adopt a healthier lifestyle in general. Happiness is considered very important in life. Why is it difficult to define? What factors are important in achieving happiness?
Happiness is very difficult to define because it means so many different things to different people. While some people link happiness to wealth and material success, others think it lies in emotions and loving personal relationships. Yet others think that spiritual paths, rather than either the material world or relationships with people, are the only way to true happiness. Because people interpret happiness for themselves in so many different ways, it is difficult to give any definition that is true for everyone. However, if there are different kinds of happiness for different individuals, then the first step in achieving it would be to have a degree of self-knowledge. A person needs to know who he or she is before being able to know what it is that makes him or her happy. Of course, factors such as loving relationships, good health, the skills to earn a living, and a peaceful environment all contribute to our happiness too. But this does not mean that people without these conditions cannot be happy. Overall, I think that an ability to keep clear perspectives in life is a more essential factor in achieving happiness. By that I mean an ability to have a clear sense of what is important in our lives, the welfare of our families, the quality of our relationships, making other people happy, etc., and what is not, a problem at work, getting annoyed about trivial things, etc. Like self-awareness, this is also very difficult to achieve, but I think these are the two factors that may be the most important for achieving happiness.
The world is consuming natural resources faster than they can be renewed. Governments should discourage people from constantly buying more up-to-date or fashionable products. To what extent do you agree or disagree?
Most countries encourage consumer spending to boost economic growth. However, many of the products purchased are discarded after only a few months' use. The more developed the economy, the more people are encouraged to buy. If people did not change their consumer durables, such as household appliances, computers, and cars, every few years, the industries which manufacture these goods would be threatened with bankruptcy. Also, when demand is insufficient, governments face a shortfall in tax revenue and are unable to fund public services, including healthcare, education, and transport. On the other hand, natural resources such as rainforests, oil, coal, and natural gas are being used up at an unsustainable rate, and alternative sources of power are slow to establish themselves. At the same time, pollution and waste disposal are becoming a major problem. Many products have built-in obsolescence. Cars, for example, are made to last only a few years, but they are intensely advertised. As a result, people's needs have long outstripped their real needs and have become artificial. People are being turned into commodities. Given the world's fast-dwindling natural resources, throwaway products may seem immoral and impractical in the long run. Although society currently relies heavily on consumption, I think it is crucial that we undergo a major shift of attitude and begin to rethink our ideas about economic growth. Consumption is desirable up to a point, but not beyond the point where it threatens to exhaust the world's resources, making our environment unsustainable and turn people into mere passive consumers. Some people think that all the new buildings should be built in traditional styles. Others, however, believe that new buildings should be built in modern styles. Discuss both views and give your own opinion.
Architects often find themselves in a dilemma when deciding whether the exterior of their design should convey a traditional feel. Modern architectural styles are generally superior to traditional styles in terms of structure, materials, and functionality. Modern industrial buildings, such as factories with large-span reinforced concrete structures, can increase productivity because they accommodate large workshops where heavy equipment can be stored and used for assembly line production. The superiority of modern architecture is also confirmed with the example of high-rise residential complexes that are more compact and therefore help urban developers to save land. Modern-style buildings also offer city dwellers better living conditions. This can be illustrated with modern commercial buildings such as shopping malls, department stores, and exhibition and conference centres that are wrapped in exquisite curtain walls. These buildings not only enable city residents to enjoy their lives more, but also liven up the cityscape. However, a traditional style of architecture may still be a sensible option for some urban projects, such as new churches and temples that represent specific cultural identities. Urban developers and architects should also carefully consider the location and surroundings of new buildings. New building projects in traditional neighbourhoods should not destroy the historical fabric with starkly contrasting designs. For a telling example, see the complaints against Frank Gehry's odd-shaped starter centre on the MIT campus. Overall, my conclusion is that the decision to design buildings in traditional styles should be made on a case-by-case basis, with specific consideration given to their location and the exact purposes that they serve. Some people think that old buildings should be protected by law because they are part of a nation's history. Others, however, think that old buildings should be knocked down to make way for new ones because people need houses and offices. What is your opinion? Should history stand in the way of progress?
People have different views about whether or not old buildings should be razed to make way for progress. Some argue that old buildings should be removed so that the development of modern cities, both in population and functionality, can be achieved. This seems reasonable. Many modern cities are overcrowded with residential, commercial, and recreational buildings. As the land available for new construction becomes increasingly scarce, some old buildings should be demolished to make room for more compact, function-specific, high-rise structures. The fast-paced and automated urban life has also made many old buildings redundant. Although architects can retrofit these buildings to meet the demands of modern lifestyles, the usefulness of such retrofitted buildings pales in comparison with that of new buildings, which are designed to serve modern needs in every detail of form and function. Those opposed to the demolition of historic buildings believe that historic and cultural considerations should take precedence over their utilitarian value. Some historic buildings uniquely represent specific historical events or have exceptional aesthetic value. There is also historic architecture that reminds us of distinctive lifestyles of the past. If all historic buildings were demolished, many irreplaceable pieces of our history, culture, and tradition would be lost. Personally, I think that urban development requires the demolition of some old buildings, but the needs of progress today should not be met at the expense of the remarkable historical and cultural value of many historic structures. The decision to remove a historic building should be made on a case-by-case basis, not based on universally applied regulations.